Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to Indie Streak. My name is Rachel Galvin, and as you know, I interview film industry professionals on this show. If you've missed any of the shows, you can listen to the archives. I've had a lot of great guests lately, including Ernest Ruffin Jr. last week, who talked about his film Caribbean Heist. Well, today I'm interviewing Megan Griffiths, director of Eden, and I think I have her on the line. Let me check here. Okay, Megan, are you there? Hold on just a second.
There we go. Hi.
There you are. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let's dive right in. I want to talk about Eden. Tell us a little bit about the plot for those that have not seen it yet.
I'm sorry, the plot?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it is based on a true story of a woman who was trafficked. She was abducted in New Mexico and held outside in a trafficking facility outside of Las Vegas as sort of a sex slave for 2.5 years before she was able to make her way out. And it's sort of the story of how she kind of overcomes her situation.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and it's interesting how you focus. Like a lot of movies would focus more on the sex part, honestly, and you focus really on the storyline of her, and I think it made it a much more poignant story and much more truthful. So did you purposely try to avoid that part of the story?
Well, it came to me as a script that was where the sort of nuts and bolts of the story were already put together by the original screenwriter Rick Phillips and Chong Kim, whose story it's based on. They had worked together on the script for a couple of years before I came into the picture, and then I sort of did a revision just to kind of focus it on, you know, streamline it and focus it on some of the central characters that you see in the film. But when we went into production and started figuring out how we were going to approach the material, we definitely made a conscious decision to avoid nudity and overtly sexual situations and just try to shoot it in a way that leaves the violence and the sexual stuff more to the viewer's imagination and create a film where it's just as sort of harrowing and disturbing without any sort of graphic nudity or graphic violence to keep people away from the film, because we wanted it to be seen by as wide an audience as possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, did this require any research on your part into human trafficking? Did you do any separate research?
I did. I mean, obviously I don't know a whole lot about this world from the inside, thankfully. So I did the research I could. I watched a lot of documentaries where they talked to survivors and read, you know, articles on the subject that I could find online, and talked to Chong Kim, obviously, was the number one resource, who was, you know, she had been through this specific story and of domestic trafficking, and so I just kind of looked everywhere I could. I watched all the narrative trafficking films I could, although most of them focus more on sort of a law enforcement angle and somebody sort of from the outside who's kind of swoops in and rescues the person, whereas this one, one of the things I liked about it was that it focuses on the girls themselves and sort of them, you know, the majority of these girls are never rescued. So, you know, it talks about what this one character does to sort of, you know, be her own hero, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like a good movie for possibly, you know, kids to watch and like what to watch out for. Did you think about that aspect of it? You know, do you think about what kids can do to avoid being picked up like this?
I mean, I think it's good to have an awareness of the things that can happen to you in this world. And so, you know, it was kind of nice to see that the people who were involved in the film, like the girls who played sort of the victims of trafficking on screen, you know, they talked to their parents about the issue and they talked to their school about the issue. And it sort of spread an awareness just even amongst the cast. And then... Sorry, my computer just started talking. they were spreading an awareness. So I'd love to see the film have that effect as well. It are because of, you know, it's really difficult to to make a film that's rated sort of G or PG or anything about an issue that's like dark and mm-hmm. intense. But so, you know, it does kind of look at the audience a little bit. But when we show film festivals, a lot of parents would bring their kids, their teenage girls particularly, so that they could open their eyes to this. I mean, I don't know if, you know, anything can stop this from happening. I mean, you know, sometimes people are just being in vulnerable situations, but I think it's good for people to sort of be aware of their surroundings and not put themselves in overly vulnerable places.
Mm-hmm. Your phone is cutting out a little bit. I don't know if you're too close to your computer, maybe. It just started cutting out a little bit. Now, how did you get involved in the project? How did you meet up with Chung Kim?
I actually, you're breaking a little bit, so I'm going to answer the question I think you asked. I came into this picture because Colin Plank, who is the producer of the film, contacted me after we worked together on my film, The Off Hours, that played at Sundance in 2011. And mm-hmm. And he thought, that, you know, I think he was happy with the way that movie turned out and thought it would be a good fit. So he brought the material to me. And he had been working on it for a couple of years by that point already with his friend Rick, the writer, and Chong. And Rick had found Chong's story in a newspaper and tracked her down through a nonprofit organization that she had at the time, and just kind of asked her if she would be interested in having a film or collaborating on a film project about her story, and she was. And so they worked on the script together by email and phone for 2 years and actually didn't meet until we were shooting.
Wow, that had to be really difficult for her to put her story down and put it out there to the world. That's had to be really brave of her.
Yeah, it was incredibly brave of her. I mean, I'm not sure what sort of what she went through in order to sort of make that decision in the first place. But she came to our cast and crew screening in Seattle and was one of the first people to see the finished film, and then came to our premiere at South by Southwest. And you know, it's got to be very surreal to see. I mean, to see your story sort of told fictionally on screen and come to terms with that, but she's been really amazing about using it as a platform to talk about the issue, and she speaks about the issue all the time.
That's great. Now, did you stick to the script once you got on set, or did it deviate? Did some of the actors, you know, change up any of the lines or anything like that?
There was definitely a little level of improv. I mean, the story itself, I didn't go in a different direction once we were shooting. You know, the script was the blueprint. Dialogue, you know, tends to change in small and large ways. But, you know, and I would say probably Matt O'Leary, who plays Vaughn, the sort of the mm-hmm. main trafficker that Eden deals with, he probably took the most liberties with the lines, but always within the character. So mm-hmm. in ways that enhanced the movie.
Yeah, he did an amazing job. All of them did. He had a great cast.
Thank you.
How did you get Bo Bridges? I met Bo a couple of years ago. How did you get him involved?
You know, we just very traditionally, actually. We had a casting director named Emily Schweber, who's an LA-based casting director. And, you know, for Vaughn and Eden, we went out and auditioned a whole bunch of people and just found people we thought were right. You know, Jamie and Matt. And for Bo, we just, you know, we sort of made a list of people we thought would be appropriate. We liked Bo because of his, you know, his normal persona is sort of the, you know, he's a good guy. He's, you know, sort of a good old boy sometimes. And mm-hmm. and it just felt like his, you know, he's sort of naturally likable. And I liked that for this character because his character functions in a dual, you know, he lives out in the world and he's a law enforcement officer and he's, you know, he appears to most people that he knows as a pillar of society. And then he has this other side of him that, you know, most people don't see, but that's what we see mostly in this film. And I thought that would be interesting, like to have somebody who you would just naturally trust in this role. And we also wanted to be able to introduce the character in the beginning and have that be a question mark of who we're meeting. And maybe in like in any other trafficking film, he would be the guy who was going to save her. And we wanted to kind of play against that instinct and kind of allow people to think that until, you know, we sort of abruptly let them know that's not who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so well, I guess the answer to this question is that we approached him through his agent, and he just, I think, responded to the idea of playing a character like this. And he and I met and talked about it and got along, and then he signed on.
That's great. What's your process as a director working with the actors? Are you very hands-on? Are you more laid back and let them go with the characters?
I mean, I guess I'm pretty hands-on, and we do a lot of talking beforehand about the character and their backstory and the relationships between their character and other characters in the film and sort of how to weave that into the movie. And so it's sort of like we lay a lot of groundwork, and then once we're on set, you know, we'll just kind of go through, you know, we'll get in, we'll do a private rehearsal where we sort of talk about the scene. And figure out the gist of it, do one for crew where we show everyone the blocking, and then if we want to go further and kind of delve into it more, we usually kind of go offset while the crew works and talk about it. But if we all feel like we're kind of on the same page, we sort of go our separate ways, and then we just, you know, come back and start doing takes. And I'm very sort of specific about moments that are in the scene, so it's usually just, you know, do a take and then talk about small adjustments in various parts of the scene and go until I feel like we have it. Not usually we have one take that's perfect, but we have all these moments in various takes.
How do you work with your DP? Did you storyboard and then show him that and kind of go from there, or did he have a lot of input?
I worked with Sean Porter on that film, and we shot listed the whole film together. We actually had an enormous amount of prep time, kind of by accident, but it was fantastic for the movie. He was there for a few months before we started shooting. We shot listed the whole thing in sort of theoretical terms. And then we went out and scouted all the locations and found everything. And then we went back to our shot list and sort of reconfigured it to fit the real locations. And then, you know, we'd have that list going on to set every day and then work off of that and usually consolidate it more based on whatever time we had to shoot.
How long was your shoot?
It was 25 days of principal photography. We went to... And then that was in Washington State. And then a very small skeleton crew went to Las Vegas for 2 days to shoot some sort of scenic stuff and some stuff with the van, but no actors.
I thought that was Vegas. I'm thinking, that's not Seattle. That's so funny.
There's a couple shots of Vegas that are sort of strategically placed throughout the film. I think there may be like five or six over the course of the movie that shots that were done in that area, but the rest, you know, most of the desert stuff was shot in central Washington, which is, there's a desert region that sort of stretches up the United States all the way through Washington, mm-hmm. and Grand Coulee Dam area. There's all these sort of buttes and sort of beautiful landscape that resembles the Vegas desert. So we ended up shooting most of any of the desert scenes with actors in them that you see are that region.
Yeah, the ending scenery is beautiful. Where was that? Was that Seattle?
Yeah, you mean the last right scene?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it's right in the sort of that central part of Washington. It's this sort of resort, actually. We shot at this phone booth that was in this resort because we wanted it to kind of have the bridge between the dry desert landscape and this more of a sort of an oasis feel. You know, there's greenery and mm-hmm. That's the only place I think in the film that we sort of allowed that greenery to poke through because, you know, just to kind of give the feeling of hopefulness, you know, whereas the rest of it's pretty stark and dry and hot.
And did you have any problem with getting locations or permits or anything like that?
No, I mean, we didn't really face that are, Sean Porter, Colin Plank, and I went out and scouted in Central Washington, and one day in early prep and found all these places we liked. And then our fantastic locations manager, Dave Drummond, basically went out and secured all of those places for the most part, you know, all of our first choices. And then he found all these great places for us in Seattle. And our main location was probably the most difficult, which was the interior of the storage facility, which, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about shooting in a real storage facility, but, you know, they're in use and they're open 24 hours and it's a really difficult location. And so what we ended up doing was finding a warehouse and using parts of the existing structure, and then the art department built the row of, you know, the hallway that you see in the film that is lined with storage rooms for each of the, where the girls live, was that row of storage rooms was built by our art department. And then they sort of converted mm-hmm. other spaces in that warehouse, like the office spaces and the bathroom, and sort of just created that world within this sort of shell of a warehouse.
Wow. You had a really large cast and crew. What was that craft service budget like? You had a lot of people.
I couldn't tell you, but yeah, I mean, it was like probably a 60 to 65 people on set.
Wow.
Crew. So, you know, it's a large, you know, decent sized indie crew, you know, but just like, you know, I think everybody was still working really hard. You know, it wasn't a lot of people sitting around. We had a really ambitious shoot and lots of things that we were trying to do in terms of like building and company moves. And, you know, we just kept everyone really busy and they were incredible.
What do you think the most challenging part overall was of making the film?
Probably just dealing with the subject matter. I mean, it was just, you know, you want to keep things moving on set and you want to keep things positive and dealing with subject matter that's this dark and difficult, and creating an environment for the actors to be able to sort of go to these places, you know, it just made us all a lot more conscious of what we were saying and what kind of jokes we were telling, and, you know, just having all these minors on set, because all the girls in the film for the most part are underage, you know, we're trying to be representative of the real world of this trafficking issue, and the median age for these girls is 13. And so we wanted to represent that. So we have all these young girls on set and they're wearing very little, and, you know, just all the men on set were just incredibly respectful, but it was just sort of keeping tabs and remembering that and always sort of keeping that respectful air while still keeping everything moving and that's, you know, sort of positive. That was sort of a difficult balance to strike, more so than most films, I think. So that was probably the number one challenge.
Was it challenging working with their hours, being that they're minors, that they have certain hours that they have to adhere to?
Yeah, we are, you know, our AD, Scott Larkin, really did a good job of working that out schedule-wise. And we only had one, one speaking role, Priscilla Janine Monterosa, who was under 18, whose hours and she had to be tutored on set. And that's, you know, that's mm-hmm. just something that it's just like a challenge to work around. But in terms of the girls who were sort of more of the background, we just kind of scheduled it around knowing what kind of time we had with them and when we were going to lose them. And, you know, I think it was probably, I had more challenges with the hours that we had the cat and kitten than I did with the girls.
Yeah, where did you get all the kittens?
We just had an animal wrangler who helped us, you know, found all those. I mean, some of the kittens aren't really kittens if you're, you know, in the wide. we had a lot of real kittens, and then we had some sort of stand-in fur balls.
Oh, really? Wow, I didn't know that. That's so funny.
That's good. I mean, I would hope not.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that. You know, you'd think that they're real, so that's funny.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely plenty of real kittens. It was difficult to, you know, having, like, small kittens on set, you know, you just, you know, as adorable as they are, you basically want to have them as little as possible because they're loud and they're unpredictable and, and you only have a certain amount of, if you think you have a limited amount of hours with underage people, you have a really limited amount of hours with underage animals.
Now, how did you secure your budget for this? How did you get money to fund the film?
I would defer. I mean, I can't really answer that question. I believe our producer, Colin, secured it through private equity.
Now, the film premiered at South by Southwest. Tell us a little bit about that and the response of the film.
That was incredible. I mean, it was interesting because I went into that not sure whether it was the right place. I love that film festival, and I've been to it several times with other films that I've produced, or it's one of my favorite festivals to go to. But I wasn't sure how this kind of subject matter would go over at that festival, because it's kind of known for genre films and comedies and there's an interactive element, and so there's just I just didn't know how people would respond to this kind of film. And so I kind of was a little trepidatious walking into that. And then we premiered we had sort of an early morning Sunday premiere on Daylight Savings Day. And then we had a lot of things that I was sort of nervous about. And then, we had our screening, and it wasn't my favorite sort of, like, there was some issues with sound and all this stuff. So I was just like kind of going, oh God, this isn't going well. And then the film ended and the applause started. And then, I went up to the stage and introduced the people who were there, and Chong got a standing ovation. And then, we did our Q&A, and people were asking questions about the film and talking, the audience talking to Chong and hearing her, answer questions after watching what she went through, I think really, really brought the house down. And it ended up being like an incredible premiere. Like, it just was a great feeling. And then, we ended up getting the audience award, and I ended up getting sharing an award for emergent female director with Amy Simetz, who directed Sunshine, but who was also the lead in my previous feature. So that was incredible. Like, we're friends, and so that was great to share that award with her. And then, Jamie got recognized for her performance, and so it just, like, the awards night was pretty fantastic for that festival, obviously.
Now, where else has it been shown? Was it sent off to other festivals as well?
Well, they chose to. We worked with a company called Phase 4, distributed the movie, and, various other distributors around the world. But they chose to sort of keep it in limited festivals. So we played in Seattle, where we also took home several awards. And then the San Diego Asian American Film Festival, where we got the audience award as well. So we played limited festivals, but it was great because we kept, sort of getting awarded at every festival we were playing at. And then it was released in theaters in March of this year, and then it's now available on VOD and DVD and pretty much any way you'd want to watch it. Although the DVD isn't called Eden, it was released under the name Abduction of Eden. So if anyone's looking for the DVD, they should look under the A's.
Okay, Abduction of Eden, okay. And it's also on Amazon, it's on iTunes, Vudu, all these different outlets.
Yep. And the DVD is available on Netflix now, too.
Great. And give us your website real quick before we forget.
Okay, one second. Let me just remind myself. I think it's edenthefilm.com. I don't want to say the wrong one. Stand by.
Yeah, I think it's it is edenthefilm.com.
Thank you. Okay, yeah, I'm right. I just pulled it up. So, yeah, edenthefilm.com. And that has the trailer, any information you could possibly want about how to find the movie, how to get involved in anti-trafficking work. A lot of people, when they watch the film, that's their answer, is like, this makes me angry that this is still going on. What can I do to stop it? And so going to our website's a good place to start there. It'll direct you to other organizations that are doing good work to stop trafficking.
Yeah, it's amazing the amount of trafficking that's going on, and it's and all over here in America as well.
It's a growing issue, and it's like it's definitely something we all need to focus our attention on and try to stop it. It's really insidious.
Mm-hmm. And this now this is your second feature. You also you mentioned before The Off Hours, which premiered at Sundance in 2011. What did you learn from making that film that changed the way that you made this film?
Well, you know, I mean, everything. I think that you take things small and large away from every experience. I'm a big advocate for taking things through the entire process. You know, if at all possible, finishing, taking something from start to finish before you start the next thing, just because you learn something from every phase. When you're editing, you learn about what you could have done better when you're covering a scene and like the kind of shots that you wish that you had so that you can take that into the next project and apply that kind of knowledge on set and, you know, just understanding what coverage works and how what you can get away with. And like, you know, an independent film, you always are struggling with time. It's always the thing that gets sacrificed. And so if, you know, knowing what you actually need when you're in a room and trying to get the scene covered before a certain time, mm-hmm. That's great to have that sort of background. But I also, you know, before The Off Hours, I had worked as an assistant director for 5 years and worked as a DP before that and an editor. And so having experience from all those different fields, you know, parts of film are just really invaluable in terms of like it. I use things that I learned from every movie that I've ever worked on, making The Off Hours, and then I used all that and more when I was making Eden, and then the next film that I just completed. So it's just like it's cumulative, and it's like you never will learn everything you need to know to be the perfect filmmaker. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always more to learn.
You also produced some films at Sundance, some other films. Tell us a little bit about that and how you got involved with those.
I've been a producer on two films of Todd Rohal's, who I went to film school with. He's another filmmaker I have huge respect for. And he made a film called The Cataclysm that I produced with Lacey Levitt, who was one of the producers on The Off Hours as well. Mm-hmm. And that film went... We made that film the same year as The Off Hours. I basically finished The Off Hours and put it in the mail to Sundance, and then we spent the next 4 weeks prepping for and then shooting The Cataclysm, and then that got sent to Sundance, a late submission, and accepted also. So it was just kind of a, you know, 2010 when we shot both of those films was such a creatively fulfilling year. And then also right after... the other film I produced for Todd was The Guatemalan Handshake back in 2004, I believe we shot, and it premiered at Slam Dance in 2006. Producing isn't something necessarily that I've ever been driven towards. You know, if I'd be given the choice, I'd always rather be directing, but I've done it on projects where it's just like I really want to support that film getting made and see it happen, and if there's something that I have in my skill set that will help that come to be, then that's what I want to do. And with Cataclysm, you know, Todd was looking to make this film, and I pulled, you know, Lacey and I were able to pull together this phenomenal Seattle-based crew to shoot, and he came up and just had this amazing experience making that film. And I've also been a co-producer on a movie called Zoo, which premiered at Sundance in 2007, and also Your Sister's Sister, Lynn Shelton's movie that was at Toronto 2 years ago and Sundance last year. So just kind of fallen into it on a few different occasions when I sort of did more than, you know, what my former title would have said, you know, because I was on all of those films, I was also the first assistant director. So it's just sort of above and beyond first AD work and earned a better credit.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice for people that are trying to get into Sundance? Is there a trick to it? Is there something that they look for to get into Sundance?
I mean, I don't know if there's a trick to it. I really try to, you know, we just, I have a philosophy of like, I don't think that it's wise to send something rough. I don't think it's a good idea to leave it to the imaginations of festival programmers to think about how you might finish your movie. You know, if at all possible in every situation, I would always submit a finished film. With the off hours, we sent a color corrected, sound mixed film. And that was what they accepted. And I don't know if they would have accepted it in rough form if they saw it that way. And I'll never know. But I've had bad experiences submitting rough cuts in my life. So I'm pretty staunch advocate for not submitting rough cuts to festivals. But that being said, when I got in and I was talking to John Cooper, who runs the festival, and he said that seeing our film, it was one of the only completed films that he watched. So I don't think that they get a lot of finished films submitted. But in that way, I think it really set us apart. And so that, you know, that was big for us. We also worked with a lot of actors in the off hours that, because I'd never played at Sundance, but the actors in the film were sort of recognizable to festival programmers, and may have kind of brought a little bit more of an attention to our film, and sort of given us an edge. But really, I don't know if there's any. I don't think there's any sort of like tricks to the. You know, I think it's just try to make the best film you can, and then if they take it, great. And if not, you know, it's not. You know, it's not because you didn't try.
Before we run out of time, I do want to mention your newest project, Lucky Them. Tell us real briefly about when we can expect that to be released and maybe a little brief statement about what that's about.
I think probably the first time anyone would get a chance to see it would be sometime next year. I'm currently in post-production on it, but it is, as you mentioned, called Lucky Them. It's about a music journalist who's played by Toni Collette, who is given an assignment by her editor at the rock magazine that she works at, who is played by Oliver Platt, to go track down this musician who's been missing for 10 years. And it also happens to be her ex-boyfriend. So kind of on her path to tracking him down, she has to come to terms with the fact that when he left the rest of the world, he left her as well. So it's sort of dealing with a lot of stuff that she's not wanted to deal with. And she teams up with this eccentric millionaire, played by Thomas J. Church, who sort of agrees to help her on her journey, in exchange for making it, you know, so he wants to make a documentary about it. And so they're sort of this odd couple on this quest together.
That sounds great. Hopefully I can bring you back and when it's all done and we'll talk about that one too.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I want to make sure we give out your personal website so that if people want to track you down, they can contact you and find out more about you. If there's any website that you have.
Eden, the film, obviously is for that film, and then I have the offhoursfilm.com, which is sort of my personal the one that I run, and it's also the only place that you can buy the off hours on DVD if anybody wants to do that. But that's also available on Netflix streaming and anywhere that you could download film, basically. But yeah, the offhoursfilm.com is the other one.
Okay, great. Well, we're running out of time, but I really thank you for being on the show today. And like I said, I'll bring you back when when you get Lucky Them done, and we'll come back and talk some more.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Okay, well, that was a great conversation with Megan Griffiths, and we're running out of time, but I wanted to talk to her more about she's involved in sustainable production. So hopefully we can talk about that next time she comes on, and we'll talk also about her new feature, Lucky Them. But Eden is a great film. I really recommend you go see it online and you know wherever else it might be offered. I did have a chance to see it, like I said, and it was very well done. So I definitely recommend that. Okay, guys. Well, it's another great show today, and I hope that you enjoyed it. Let's see what's going on. If you missed the American Black Film Festival, just happened. It just ended. It ran June I think it was June 19th through 23rd here in Miami, and there were some great people down here. I don't know if Robert Townsend showed up, but his film Playing for Love was here. Regina King, Nick Cannon were down here. A lot of great people. Unfortunately, I missed the film festival, but if you missed it too, you can check the website and find out about it next year. They have some amazing seminars, a whole list of seminars that they had. I need to go to this next year. I was just looking at their website, and I'm like, darn it, I missed it. But the website for the American Black Film Festival is www.abff.com. Make sure to check that out. And if you're a filmmaker out there and you'd like to be on this show, please contact me, and I would be happy to look at your stuff. My email is ravenprods@yahoo.com. That's ravenprods@yahoo.com. And send me your stuff. I'll take a look, and we'll go from there. And also, if you've missed any of the shows, go back and listen to the archives, because I have a list of great people. Like I mentioned last week, I interviewed Ernest Ruffin Jr., who not only is a filmmaker for Caribbean Heist, but also is involved with the NBA and the WNBA. And, of course, the NBA is on our minds right now with the Heat winning. Go Heat. So he gave a great show, a great interview as well, because he's also an entrepreneur and very inspirational in what he's been able to accomplish. So go back and listen to that one. And I interviewed Jacques Derosina about the Cannes Film Festival and about his films Meth Head and Murder 101 before that. So I've got over 70 episodes for you to listen to, and they're all different. So check them out, and please share them with friends. And also please like my Facebook page, which is Indie Streak, just like this show, because I am putting information not only about the shows, but primarily about special events, castings, different things, not only in Florida, but elsewhere as well. And as you know, I interview filmmakers from around the world, so don't feel like you have to be here in Florida. In fact, Megan, who I just interviewed, is in Seattle, for example. So I talk to people all over the place. But guys, that's the end of this episode today, but I will be back next Sunday at 1 o'clock, same bat channel, same bat time, and please tune in, and I will talk to you then. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.